try to reduce the heat themselves. So they are forced to shower at least 5 times a day in order to protect their bodies from oversweating or from skin diseases. They also spray water on their beds and pillows to produce a little coolness, but that quickly fades away. Prisoners are allowed one small fan in each room, but this only moves the hot air around and doesn't reach the four corners of the room. Prison authorities are also known to cut off electricity from the cells during the day, meaning prisoners cannot even use the fan. Meanwhile, the hot plate used for cooking and heating food makes the cells more stuffy. As a result, some prisoners avoid using it during the summer, eating cold, canned food instead, according to Abu As'ab. He said, "In our normal situation outside the prison, we can't think, work, sleep or live in general if we don't have an air conditioner. So you can imagine what being deprived of cooling does to prisoners who are already suffering from harsh conditions and unfair sentences." Bayan Farun, 28, was detained for 40 months in the Daemon prison located near the coastal city of Haifa and describes the detention facility, which holds 30 female Palestinian prisoners, as an oven. She said, "We shared one fan that was useless. And unfortunately, our prison conditions were more difficult than the rest of the prisoners. As the shower was located outside our section and we were only allowed to use it once a day, at hours determined by the prison administration. Meanwhile, the only refrigerator for the prisoners was located outside their section and was closed daily from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m., depriving prisoners of access to cold food and drinks." Farun said, "Because of the intense heat and our need for cold water, we used to bring in the vegetable box and turn it into a small refrigerator by placing water bottles inside, which we had previously frozen, and cool anything we wanted by placing it on top of the bottles. But after a few hours, it becomes warm again." Many female prisoners suffer from bullet wounds sustained during their arrest that sting in the heat. However, Isra Jabis from Al-Quds suffers from deep burns that cover 50% of her body and make the high summer temperatures particularly agonizing. The vehicle she was traveling in exploded just before she was arrested in 2015 for allegedly attempting to carry out an operation against the Zionist regime forces. Farun said Jabis, with whom she shared a prison section, could sometimes be found crying from pain caused by the effect the heat has on her burnt skin. Jabis also experienced shortness of breath that got worse as the humidity increased in the prison, which, like many others, lacks cooling and ventilation. There are more than 5,000 Palestinians currently incarcerated in Zionist regime prisons. While some of these may be in hotter locations than others, all are exposed to uncomfortable temperatures. Amina Al-Tawil, a researcher at the Palestine Center for Prisoner Studies, told Middle East Eye that the cells holding Palestinian prisoners are closed from all sides, with no proper ventilation, while the fans inside the rooms only circulate hot air. The prisoners who suffer most from the heat are detained in prisons located in particularly extreme locations: Naqab, Rimmon, Nafha, and Eshel, in the occupied territories south. These hold nearly half of the total number of Palestinian prisoners. The detainees have described these locations as a piece of hell, where their bodies roast in the intense heat. Tawil said several cases of heat stroke, fainting, and shortness of breath have been recorded this year, adding that the conditions are dangerous for ill prisoners who already don't have access to adequate medical care. She added, instead of helping them, the prison administration sometimes punishes the prisoners by confiscating the fans. Last July, the Naqab Desert saw temperatures reach 50 degrees Celsius, making it impossible for prisoners to go out into the prison yards. Meanwhile, the sweltering heat also brings out poisonous reptiles, insects, and scorpions, which can easily find their way into prison sections, further endangering the lives of prisoners, said Tawil. But as summer ends, Palestinian prisoners are forced to begin preparing for the winter season, which brings with it another challenge, the cold, alongside the continuing pressure applied by the Zionist regime prison authorities, whatever the season. According to Palestine Chronicle, over 600 Palestinian prisoners suffer from different kinds of diseases. 126 of them suffer from chronic diseases, including 26 who have been diagnosed with cancer, according to the Prisoners Affairs Authority. Unfortunately, many cancer-stricken patients have already lost their lives in Israeli regime jails throughout the years. Aside from cancer, the bad living conditions in Israeli regime prisons are conducive to the spread of various diseases. Prisoners only eat canned food. Their cells lack hygiene, and the prisons are overcrowded. In many cases, Palestinian prisoners do not declare that they are sick because of the long procedures to receive treatment and the deliberate policy of medical negligence implemented by Israeli regime authorities. Additionally, the Zionist regime regularly denies prisoners the right to be transported to hospitals or medical institutions under the pretext of overcrowding.
Higher education in America.
Part 1.
American media found a relatively new subject in the middle of 2019. Rivalry between the presidential candidates made every comment an attractive news headline. For example, Republican Donald Trump spoke in favor of the U.S. by immigration reduction and the development of foreign policy. On the other side, Democrat Joe Biden stressed the need for controlling the COVID-19 pandemic and respecting the rights of minorities in the U.S.
The Supreme Court Justice, radical question. Left.
Will you
who
shut
is
up,
your,
man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
who's
is
on
so
your
correct.
List?
Gentlemen,
this
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
He's going to pack the court.
We have
not going to give a list.
We have ended this segment. We're going to move on to the second segment.
That was really a productive segment, wasn't it?
Of course, the Democratic Party had another candidate besides Joe Biden. 78-year-old Bernie Sanders was another lesser-known candidate of the Democratic Party, a leftist senator who had different things to say than his rivals. The elderly Bernie Sanders made a strange promise to his supporters just a few days before the internal party debate. In the form of a proposal, he promised to completely forgive student debt. This promise seemed strange, but there was an even stranger issue. Bernie Sanders announced an incredible figure for American student debt. He said that American students owed about $1,600 billion to the U.S. banks. He said that the new generation must not be in debt during the lifetime due to the crime of studying at the university.
This proposal completely eliminates student debt in this country and ends the absurdity of sentencing an entire generation, the millennial generation, to a lifetime of debt for the crime of doing the right thing, and that is going out and getting a higher education.
Bernie Sanders' shocking words were almost familiar to the American audience. Because the U.S. student debt had become a newsflash about a month before his speech.
An incredible act of generosity. It has changed the lives of hundreds of students. The commencement speaker at Morehouse College vowing to pay off the student loans of every graduate in the class of 2019 to the tune of $40 million.
This part of the news was related to Robert F. Smith. He's an entrepreneur, billionaire, and former university student at Morehouse College. He was aware of the problems of student loans, so he pledged to pay off $40 million in student loans for Morehouse College class of 2019. He made this statement during the graduation ceremony. Of course, students didn't receive this amount of money, and it was donated to pay off their loans. This amount of money could change the lives of students completely. The matter was related to tens of thousands of dollars in student debt and the future of these students at Morehouse College. If he did not donate that amount of money to pay off the student loan debt, each of his classmates would have to spend the next 25 years paying off their debts to the banks, just like other American students. Robert Smith's decision and the feedback in public showed the importance of student loans. People like Robert Smith and Bernie Sanders wanted to cancel education debt. In those days, Bernie Sanders said that he stood against the laws of capitalism and its rapacity. Everyone knew about the results of such disastrous laws. Few people were aware of their procedure and function.
Why are we punishing millions of people because they chose to get an education? That makes no sense.
The university system in America is more like a black box. Even the people who work inside the university are not properly aware of its conditions. Of course, the only obvious thing is the increasing number of young people entering universities. Young people and their families have to borrow from banks if they have not saved extra money for education. Banks take a financial commitment from students in exchange for paying the tuition fees. This financial commitment is considered in installments of several years. There is also another point. The interest of this amount of money increases day by day, and if students don't get a job, they will have to pay back more. So the figure that Bernie Sanders mentioned in his speech was not so unusual.
There is now more than $1.7 trillion in student loan debt. And this isn't just some sort of, you know, young person millennial issue. This really touches every facet of American lives, both individuals, their communities, our economy, and our country.
Since 2000, every student loan is paid with 30% interest. About half of the students have to either drop out of school or accept the terms of repayment to the banks. In 2012, the average debt of per American graduate was more than $25,000. Regarding students' field of study, There were some strange cases where their debt has exceeded $100,000 over the years. These heavy debts have changed the lives of students and their families. Some families have to take other loans from the banks to compensate their children's loans. Loans taken to pay off another loan. These heavy debts have also affected the lives of graduates. Buying a house, starting a family, and continuing the education seem to be dreams by considering the heavy debts. Of course, this issue is specific to students who have been able to graduate. The shocking statistics of students dropping out or extending their studies show that student loans are devastating. From 2007 to 2013, only 56% of American students graduated from public universities. There are other statistics indicating that as of 2012, 68% of American students failed to graduate within 4 years. In some U.S. states, the situation is even worse. In California, despite a significant number of the best universities in the world, it took more than 4 years for 84% of students to graduate. The truth is that the rising cost of living has aggravated the dropout or prolongation of education day by day. For instance, if we compare cost of education, health, and food over 40 years, we understand the new dimensions of this crisis. From 1980 to 2010, the cost of food and health increased by 200 and 600% respectively, but the cost of education has been accompanied by inflation of 1,120%. So American universities must be the worst educational centers in the world and on the verge of closure. But surprisingly, that is not happening. Universities in the United States are questionably famous and popular. In many rankings, 8 of the top 10 universities in the world are American universities. In 2021, Shanghai Ranking announced that for the 19th consecutive year, Harvard University was the best university in the world. Stanford, MIT, Berkeley, Princeton, Columbia, California, and Chicago were other American universities on that list. Their rankings made them to be a model for other scientific centers in the world. According to this institution, the rating criteria can be summarized in several points: the number of Nobel and Fields medals, the number of influential researchers, and the number of scientific articles. Although these criteria place American universities at the top of the list, there are other issues. The question is, how reliable are these ranking lists? These ranking institutes, like Times Higher Education, have a strange and unclear way of work. The strangest institute is QS World University Rankings in the United Kingdom. In QS method, each university can hire people in advance to participate in the survey according to their interests. Money plays an important role in recruitment. It is clear that who receives this amount of money from universities. QS receives money and also gives advice to universities. They help universities to increase their rankings. These are not consultations about teaching style or academic structure, but about cheating in rankings. Behind the QS's list, there is not a reliable research, but an industry. They treat education as a business. QS sales rankings to university presidents, and applicants for the higher education are deceived by the university's reputation and rankings. Of course, cheating is not the only problem in these lists. Some believe that the method of ranking organizations are not professional and therefore unreliable.
When you really scrutinize these rankings and the methods of how they're done, what happens? How are they done?
Well, they're not. It's not a scientific methodology. In fact, the major factor is what all the schools think of each other. So all schools in a particular category, like National University category, they all rank each other on a 1 to 5 scale every year. So, of course, it's absurd. What does somebody at San Diego State know about what's going on at University of Connecticut or University of Missouri, where I went to school? It's a flawed way of evaluating schools.
You mentioned in your book that reputation is very important in the U.S. news ranking. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by reputation?
Well, you know, it's just kind of a general feeling that schools have about the kind of quality of education that's going on at their peer institutions. It's kind of a nebulous thing. Like, how do you measure reputation?
So if Harvard has a great reputation, right, or UCLA, that might get a higher
Yeah, they'll get a 5, right? Everybody's heard of Harvard. Everybody thinks, you know, of UCLA. They're going to give it a very good ranking, just automatically.
Times Higher Education doesn't reveal the information about the locations of participants in the surveys. The qualification of the participants in this survey is also unclear. Shanghai Ranking has another problem as well. This organization ranks universities based on vivid criterion and not the hidden ones. For example, a university that has medical and engineering fields may receive higher rankings. These rankings are based on medals, researchers, and the number of medical and mathematical articles. But what about other fields? It is a bitter joke to evaluate universities' fields of arts and humanities with the fields or Nobel medals. These academic fields are influenced by medical and engineering fields without being present in the rankings. In this way, universities that have medical or engineering fields are always on the top of the list, even if they have a poor performance in other fields.
There's a few different ways that students typically plagiarize. One way is that they completely take a different article, story, something someone else wrote, and they just change the name and turn it in as their own. That's definitely plagiarism, and very intentional. Another intentional way that students plagiarize is that they will take pieces of other articles, maybe from one article or maybe from multiple different articles or books, and they'll patch them together and maybe have a transition sentence or two in between, but it's mostly someone else's work. And again, that's obviously an example of plagiarism.
Perhaps the most important criterion for ranking is article production, but it is better to ask under what process these articles are written. Academic plagiarism by students is the first challenge. In this case, students ask illegal institutes to provide them with an article instead of writing it themselves. In short, articles that are the main ranking criteria are only purchased and not produced, but not everything is related to cheating. The academic publishing industry is more influential than academic cheating. The academic publishing industry is a huge business with an annual revenue of £19 billion. It's very simple. Students and scientists must write academic papers to gain academic credit and develop their work, but these papers are valid only when they are published. Students send their articles to academic journals for free, but their goal is not only the development of science. The managers of these academic journals sell the work of the article writers to others. Customers of scientific journals are governments and public libraries. Libraries of scientific centers and research institutes are the next customers of these articles. This strange cycle apparently has scientific goals, but is like a production line. It does not matter what is written and produced. What is important is to earn money from these writings. Universities need to produce articles to improve rankings, and these articles must be published. Scientific journals have already realized these essentials. So the secret behind the fame and popularity of some universities is revealed. These scientific centers had a different performance many years ago.
Certain economic truths have become self-evident. Among these, the right to a good education.
Right after the Second World War, the GI Bill was passed, which made it possible for men who would never have been allowed to walk onto a college campus except perhaps as members of the custodial staff or as delivery boys to actually walk through the gates as students.
Over 2 million veterans took advantage of the GI Bill. This was an opportunity that was free, given by the government, and it made a difference to the American middle class.
That expansion of the franchise of higher education was really so unprecedented, and it led directly to the Higher Education Act of 1965, creating the federal student aid programs.
This law means that a high school senior can apply to any college and not be turned away because his family is poor.
Higher education in America was almost free during the middle years of the 20th century. Students could receive scholarships, and everyone had access to education. Education rules were set in a way that young people experienced a more important stage of life in universities. This stage led to building a bright future. But this bright future soon entered a dark era. The 1960s was marked by protests. Blacks, women, and environmentalists and peace activists started to protest. Continuous demonstrations and extensive social changes gradually worried the politicians. There were civil rights movements, and universities were among the main centers of protests. Pro-government theorists considered these protests a crisis of democracy. In their opinion, there was too much freedom in America. Otherwise, people would not come to the streets. The escalation of protests made monopolistic businesses and capitalist supporters more worried. Of course, the solution was simple. Economic and social theorists considered the educational system to be the main culprit of these protests. In their opinion, the university had not fulfilled its duty to train obedient people. These theorists had only one suggestion to solve the problem: crashing the educational system through the economy. If the students were involved in lifelong debt to the banks, they would not have a chance to protest. They believed that by removing the economic security from the people, the security of the politicians will be fully ensured. Accordingly, the university system in the U.S. gradually changed. Under the pretext of rising university costs, free education was forgotten, and students had to pay tuition. In the last 40 years, the number of professors in relation to students has remained constant, but the number of managers and administrative staff has increased in relation to students. On the other hand, the official employment of professors is somehow over. Now, most of the university professors work under a contractual agreement and live in economic insecurity. The current situation is the result of neoliberals in power, like Ronald Reagan.
Conservative governors, especially Governor Reagan of California, had really run on the idea that higher education was a wasteful way to spend taxpayer money. Governor Reagan actually said the state should not subsidize intellectual curiosity. And he ran for president later on a promise to disband the Department of Education.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Biden is seeking $40 billion in emergency funds for Ukraine and disaster relief. That total includes $13 billion in military aid to Ukraine, as well as billions of dollars more in funding to replenish a dwindling pot of federal disaster relief, according to two people with direct knowledge of the request. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. China Daily wrote, "The United States' flow of military and economic aid to Ukraine will rise by more than $20 billion if Congress approves a request that the White House made recently. The $20.3 billion, part of a larger $40 billion request, includes $13 billion in military aid for Ukraine in its conflict with Russia and $7.3 billion in economic and humanitarian assistance. It also includes $3.3 billion for infrastructure projects in regional countries impacted by the war. Since the start of the crisis in Eastern Europe in February 2022, the U.S. Congress has authorized $113 billion in overall funding related to Ukraine. If the new package is approved, that total will reach about $137 billion. The wider bill also includes money to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative, about $12 billion for natural disaster recovery in the U.S. and billions of dollars more to protect the U.S. southern border, along with funds to stem drug trafficking. The White House reportedly was expected to include aid to Taiwan to the bill, but that was not included. The $40 billion in funding will be in the form of an emergency supplemental package, a type of spending not limited by the debt ceiling deal reached between the White House and House Republicans in June. Shalonda Young, director of the White House's Office of Management and Budget, in a letter to House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, urged swift action on the U.S. commitment to Ukraine. A senior administration official told CNN, "We don't know how much longer this war is going to go on or how much more assistance we might need to support Ukraine. We won't be bashful about going back to Congress beyond the first quarter of next year if we feel like we need to do that." The Biden administration's request came after a poll from CNN found that 55% of Americans are against more spending on the conflict in Eastern Europe. Also, in the CNN poll, 51% said the U.S. already has done enough to help the Eastern European nation, which is not a member of NATO. Partisan cracks are emerging over the continuing funding to Ukraine, with support dropping among Republicans. The aid request sets up a potential battle with Republicans in Congress, some of whom have been skeptical over providing Ukraine any more money. McCarthy has said he doesn't support a blank check for Ukraine. After the debt ceiling deal passed, he said he wasn't prepared to support additional funding for Ukraine, arguing that it would be a violation of the deal. McCarthy said working on a supplemental right now is only blowing up the agreement. That's all about spending more money. So, no, I do not support a supplemental. 70 House Republicans voted in July on an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act to strip Ukraine of all American military aid. The measure failed, but revealed substantial opposition. Representative Chip Roy of Texas, a member of the House Freedom Caucus that has often clashed with McCarthy, said this should be a non-starter for House GOP. It's time to stand up for Americans and against uniparity. There is a difference of opinion between House and Senate leadership on Ukraine funding. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate GOP Leader Mitch McConnell both support continuing aid to Ukraine. McConnell, speaking in Louisville, Kentucky, recently said, "People think, increasingly it appears, that we shouldn't be doing this. Well, let me start by saying we haven't lost a single American in this war. Most of the money that we spend related to Ukraine is actually spent in the U.S. replenishing weapons, more modern weapons. So it's actually employing people here and improving our own military for what may lie ahead." Mick Wallace, a member of the European Parliament from Ireland, wrote, "A lot of politicians and mainstream media are happy to continue supporting and fueling the U.S.-NATO proxy war in Ukraine. These are not the people dying in this stupid war. How much do these people really care about the working-class Ukrainians who are dying?" Also, Canadian journalist Aron Mate wrote, "Biden administration encouraged Ukraine to integrate into NATO and assault Donbas. It refused to seriously address Russia's December 2021 proposals. After the crisis, it blocked a peace deal. It then pushed Ukraine into a counteroffensive it knew had no chance. Then it told Ukraine it won't join NATO anyway. Now it wants another $20.6 billion to prolong the war it provoked. Warren Davidson, a former Army Ranger, wrote, "Again, without a defined mission, how can we ever say mission accomplished? We can't keep sending aid without clear rationale for its intended purpose. And no, as long as it takes is not a sufficient answer." Also, according to Politico, Biden's emergency aid pitch will almost certainly cause additional angst on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers face a tight timeline to avert a government shutdown by September 30. House conservatives have pushed for further cuts to government funding, already jeopardizing the passage of new spending bills before the White House's request for additional cash.
Hidden Files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. People who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, "Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists." Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. Now, more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the War on Terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the War on Terror today. But was this War on Terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter.
United States Marine Corps intelligence officer who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted, this was unjust, this was horrible, and we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections, and so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq, to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, own between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin, total sales $46.5 billion, gross profit $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing, total sales $68.7 billion, gross profit $4 billion. 3. BAE, total sales $30.7 billion, gross profit $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics, total sales $32.7 billion, gross profit $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman, total sales $26.4 billion, gross profit $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brar regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Laocoon. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001 was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq, and famously Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said, it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said that around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact the list of seven other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon, and White House, because let's not forget it was all three sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, you know, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, you know, U.S. a right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. You know, it was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy. They would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the U.S. state and in particular U.S. companies, you know, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going in. Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout U.S. diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the U.S., and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein and this very important. Iraq has perhaps 10 to 15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. What were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. U.S. has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many US defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, you know, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, there were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extraction.